Oh, hello, everyone. You are about to hear our episode about the Nutcracker, and admittedly, we're regifting it from 2013, but it's not because we don't like it. It's because we really thought that it would look better on you. Also, we're about to go on a little break, but before we go, we made you something special. We've got a two-part series coming up about the music of the Coen Brothers movies to take you into the new year, so expect that coming up in the following weeks, and also a You're Welcome. And while it's not entirely classical music-based, it is entirely awesome-based. Also, we genuinely wish you peace and joy in this holiday season, and most importantly, that you get all the toys that you want. And speaking of toys, if you want to get us a present, please make sure to subscribe to and rate us and review us on iTunes. And that's it. Enjoy the episode. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music voice.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me in the studio today is Michael Remsen, who is a composer, author, educator, administrator, and executive director of the American Festival for the Arts, which provides music education for young people. We also have Shelley Power, who is the academy director at the Houston Ballet. Both of you, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Very excited because you guys are going to be teaching me about the Nutcracker from two different perspectives
now
today.
Have you been to the Nutcracker?
A long time ago. I was actually...
How old were you?
Oh, I was in junior high. Yeah. So, and I mean, honestly, that was probably the first time I had heard classical music performed live. Definitely the first time I had seen ballet performed live. So, and I think that's probably true for a lot of people.
I think it's important. The piece is probably, you know, more than any other piece of classical music and certainly of ballet as the entry point for young people. Mm-hmm. To experience the beauty of ballet and the beauty of this incredible score written by Tchaikovsky and to experience the wonderment. And what better choice could there be on some levels, because it's a story it's a story filled with magic, colors, and provocative harmonies and just that help run the entire gamut of emotions. And through the dancers and through the dancers acting the story and the emotions of the music, children and adults, frankly, are just swept away in the wonderful drama of the whole experience.
The magic of it is there's messages for the children, but there's also this adult message as well, and there's humor. And so the Nutcracker does provide that for all audience ages. Mm-hmm. And it's just the first time to be able to see a ballet. It just really is easy
to
be able to understand.
You know, you've got the whole Christmas mythology that the Nutcracker is now, you know, very much a part of.
You've got your Christmas tree and you've got your Nutcracker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so for young people, I know for me, that was very appealing.
It's tradition. You know, well, it brought a tradition into your family. They're symbols exactly.
They're symbols of the holiday season.
Yeah, getting presents. Basically, it was a precursor to getting presents. I mean, let's be honest.
And Clara did get a present. She got the Nutcracker.
She gets the Nutcracker.
And so how are the two of you involved in the annual production of the Nutcracker, or at least this year.
Michael, are you dancing this year?
My trick knee has come back, and so I will not be dancing.
Oh,
you will
so
not
be
sad.
Performing. But I'm in charge of the school. We have approximately 160 students that are actually dancing in the Nutcracker. Mm-hmm. So I'm in charge of making sure that they all are well rehearsed, and they have to be fitted, costumed, and then there's 35 to 37, depending which year we're talking about, performances of Nutcracker that you have to coordinate getting them there. So that's what I'm in charge of.
Man.
And for me, one of the programs of American Festival for the Arts is the Houston Girls Chorus program, which we do in collaboration with Houston Grand Opera's HGO Co. And the girls are the house chorus for the Houston Ballet Orchestra. And there's one section, which we'll listen to a little later, that involves a children's chorus in the Nutcracker score. And my girls are down there. And so we have 55 girls who will rotate through the various performances.
Wow. What a feat. 23.
Ask me December 29th.
Oh, my goodness. This is very exciting. So what about the Nutcracker? Because, I mean, this is a huge subject.
Of course. It's a huge undertaking, and we want to spend some time delving into the history of the story itself a little bit and how the ballet came about, and listen to a few excerpts, just some special sections where some cool things happen in the ballet or where there's some particularly beautiful music and beautiful dancing happening at the same time.
And as traditions are important in our lives for holidays and for families, I think Nutcracker has been a part of everyone's holiday season in one way or another, whether it's a commercial on TV or they've seen the Disney version or they've come to Houston Ballet to see the performance. And I think what's interesting, as anyone's family traditions change, so has the Nutcracker over many, many years. The choreography and story has changed quite a bit. Maurice Petipas first choreographed the Nutcracker in 1892. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Clara has her name changed, but also the age of Clara has changed depending on which Nutcracker and who choreographed it. So that role has changed from a small child to an adult, back to a child, back to an adult.
And we should talk about who Clara is for those three people out there who have never seen the Nutcracker.
Well, Clara is the central character who goes on an adventure. Mm-hmm. Some would say it's a dream. Some would say it was a magic spell. But basically, she has a holiday Christmas party with her family. Lots of friends gather. And it's the story of her receiving a nutcracker from some versions are Uncle Drosselmeyer, some are the Godfather, some are mm-hmm. Dr. Drosselmeyer. But he comes and he has what some would believe is magical powers, and he presents toys at the party for all the children, and they gather around and they watch the toys come to life. And then Clara goes to sleep in many versions where Drosselmeyer comes and there's a magic spell that's put on her. And the story evolves from there, with the Nutcracker turning into a prince and the mice and soldiers having their fight, and then into the Land of Sweets for Act Two. So Clara's role, she travels through this whole experience or adventure or dreamlike reality. Mm-hmm. And so Clara's role has really changed over the years.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you call it a nightmare, because it sounds so dreamy, you know, when you're listening to the Sugar Plum Fairy dance.
Once she makes that transition to the dreamy part, mm-hmm. and that she does overcome the Rat King who fights with the Nutcracker, and the spell is broken,
right.
It does seem like a nightmare. The mice, especially in Houston Ballet's version, the mice are very, very large, and they do have a big part of that act one is the fight scene.
I like the idea that there's a fight scene in a ballet. That's very, it just makes me think of like a kung fu movie. But
well, and it's very dramatic. I mean, it's, and especially in the ballet version, if you ever walk around in the building, as I am fortunate to be able to do sometimes, and there you see all the mice costumes hanging out, and they're actually a little scary when you even just see them off stage. They're big and they're hairy, and they're intended to be a little bit frightening. And, mm-hmm. and even the Nutcracker has sort of a dark past. I mean, the original story was a lot darker. And it was really sort of the revision by Hoffman, who was best known to opera lovers to the Tales of Hoffman from that opera. And he wrote this revised version that was much more child-friendly, which still, you know, as many, many stories, especially from the 19th century, you know, do have sort of scary elements for children, because that's how children learned life lessons. And Clara is very much our protagonist, and we see the entire world of this wonderful world on stage through her eyes, which is why the show appeals so much to children, and why it appeals to adults, because we remember that childlike wonder of growing up and the lessons we learn and things. Shelley was talking about the Drosselmeyer scene, and what happens is that the clock strikes 12 and the magic spell starts to take effect.
This is when all of the parents are leaving and Clara's tucked in her bed. Mm-hmm. And she's sound asleep, and Drosselmeyer comes out through the wings,
mm-hmm.
and he looks up at the clock, and he walks over to her bed, and you see him circle his hand above her,
mm-hmm.
as if the spell is then happening. The tree starts to flicker, mm-hmm. and light up, and if you remember, the Christmas tree grows and grows and grows,
yes.
during the scene.
And here for our first music, you know, one of the things to talk about is, and for people to really engage in, is the tremendous sense of orchestral color, mm-hmm. that the Russian composers, and especially Tchaikovsky, were able to achieve. And just these spectacular sections where just, you know, the brass here that are saved for a dramatic, punchy moment. You know, previously, the harp and the very high ranges of the flutes and the piccolos to evoke a sense of childlike wonder. And then, you know, we have the contrast of lower ranges here for frightening or scary things starting to happen. And we still associate, mm-hmm. I think, as in, there's the chiming of the bells. And in music, you know, higher things we associate with, you know, childlike things or heaven. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, the old days, the trombones in the early operas were meant to signify the darker world, if you will. And
right.
so we still carry those associations, and Tchaikovsky uses them so beautifully with these colors.
And then the mice are about to appear,
mm-hmm.
at this moment. And Clara awakens to this big mouse, mm-hmm. at her bed. And she takes her pillow and she slams it down on the mouse's head.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, you know, it's rather comical.
Right.
It's a little scary, but they never cross over that threshold of being so frightening. I think children ages 2 and up come to see this, and they're just mesmerized by these mice who are bigger than life.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on point shoes also, so they're scurrying around the stage in these cute little point shoes.
Right. You know, Michael, as you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that you were saying that the trombones play at a particularly dark moment,
mm-hmm.
and other instruments play at other moments. How different it must be as a composer to write for a ballet, knowing that the piece will be performed and that your music is not only, you know, it's not just a piece of music, it's actually cueing dancers, it's telling a story.
Absolutely. I mean, not only does the music have to be danceable too, you know, that dancers that they can achieve the movements and things, you know, so you look for steady meters and steady tempos to accommodate dancers, but the you know, there are two things that are telling us the story, just as in an opera,
mm-hmm.
but in ballet it's the dancing and it is the colors of the music, and it's the harmonies of the music and the tension. Even here you can hear we're building through sequence, through increasing tension to a dramatic moment. And so the music has to work in tandem with the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that Petipa was so insistent on the exact number of measures he wanted for every scene,
mm-hmm.
in the Nutcracker, exactly how many bars of music he wanted to achieve the dance that he wanted to put into place.
Oh my goodness.
And so imagine that task. It's like, okay, well, not only do you have to, you know, evoke all these emotions as a composer, but you have to do it within this exact constraint of this meter and this number of bars and this tempo. And that's quite a challenge, and it speaks a lot to the great composers of ballet, Tchaikovsky being, of course, one of the greatest,
mm-hmm.
and what they were able to accomplish dramatically with this music. It's you know, but so much of it does come from this great sense of color.
Yeah. And so this is the Nutcracker who is dancing with Clara. he's appeared from underneath the bed. He surprises her and pops up, and now he's a bigger-than-life nutcracker that mm-hmm. she had sleeping in bed with her, this little toy, and it comes to life. And he's getting rid of the mice until, of course, the Rat King comes along, and then he mm-hmm. has his battle with the Rat King. Mm-hmm.
You know, and just as we were talking about how, like, low brass especially can often be used to evoke mm-hmm. evil or dark, you know, dark characters or things like that, but it can also be used, as it is here, in triumph, you know, to give right. us the feeling of triumph. And so much of that stems, of course, from the harmony and the intervals in the music and things mm-hmm. like that. But it, you know, here we have the brass being used to picture the triumph of the Nutcracker mm-hmm. over the Rat King.
And this is when actually the rats appear, or the mice, the rats.
The mice and the rats. Aren't rats
what
just
is it with
mice?
You, Michael? Last time you were on the show, we were also talking about rats.
Was it?
Yeah.
Must be a theme.
The first mouse is down.
Oh.
You heard the cannon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the Nutcracker has brought soldiers with him.
Mm-hmm.
He has his army.
And hear the use of militaristic rhythms to, mm-hmm. you know, the dum ba bum ba bum ba bum 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 gives
the
us
snare.
That.
Snare.
So there's a lot of different patterns on the stage relating to the music, military feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the snare drum, of course, completely evokes a sense of militarism. And
right.
Again, it's about how you use those colors, because everything is subservient. All of the music is subservient to the drama and has to make sure that it is moving the drama along, mm-hmm. just as it does an opera.
This is backtracking a little bit, but did we talk about when this, what year this debuted?
1892.
Okay.
You know, a fascinating time in music history, just as a general thing, if you think of the things that are roughly contemporaneous to this, like Tchaikovsky's language mm-hmm. harmonically is a little bit more conservative than a lot of the things that were happening. I mean, we're verging into composers like Bruckner and Debussy and Mahler, you know, mm-hmm. who are becoming much more active. And Tchaikovsky's language is a little bit more conservative, but to me, at least, and I'm sure there's hundreds of people who'd love to argue this point with me, but to me, I think that's necessary in the context of working in a kind of situation where you have narrative music, where the music is subservient to a story and things. And we need those musical cliches, for lack of a better term, to help us dramatically move through the story. And Tchaikovsky is a master of that. But the language is a little bit more conservative than certainly Debussy. I don't think mm-hmm. anyone would argue that.
Yeah. What's happening now in the story?
Well, the Rat King and the Nutcracker are fighting, and I was relating to what you were saying with the amount of instruments that are being used and the change in music. When there's a larger group of the soldiers and mice on the stage fighting, and then it's the Nutcracker and the Rat with the mice off to the sides, and so you can hear that in the music, but mm-hmm. you also hear it building,
mm-hmm.
and there's more activity going on in the stage, and there's movement here from side to side with the Rat King and the Nutcracker with mm-hmm. their swords. They're going back and forth.
Well, it was interesting, a little bit earlier in the music, there was a section where there was an interplay between the trumpet, a solo trumpet, and the piccolo, or either it was a piccolo or very high flute. And you can see how those instruments are being used in an imagistic way to the trumpet associated with the Nutcracker, the heroism, of course, mm-hmm. of the trumpet, and then the piccolo, I think it was the piccolo in this case, to illustrate the squeakiness, you know, of the mouse in right. some ways. And so same musical theme, but juxtaposing them against each other one after another to illustrate the sense of battle.
Right.
We've obviously transitioned because the music's gotten
Clara
much
has
soapier.
Taken her point mm-hmm. shoe and hit the King Rat, and he is gone. And then the Nutcracker is released from the spell of being a Nutcracker into the prince. Uh-huh. And he appears like
creepy.
Magic.
So now she's got a big prince standing in her room.
Well, it's not creepy. It's, no, beautiful,
it's beautiful
and romantic.
I would be creeped out.
It's every girl's fantasy.
You know, I was noticing that during the last part before the Nutcracker is released from his spell, the music had become very much like sort of like a movie score,
mm-hmm.
like Tchaikovsky.
It's
in that
exactly
part.
It
was
the
very
same thing.
Yeah, he was very much scoring the action.
Well, and if you ever go and read, I mean, I teach film music, and if you ever go and read interviews, especially with the early masters, but even the late masters of film scoring, they'll tell you that the models for excellent film scoring are ballet and opera, because mm-hmm. it's all the same thing. It's all narrative music. It's all storytelling with music. Mm-hmm. And especially the relationship between film and ballet, more so than opera, because they're both instrumental. There's no vocal line, there's no singer telling a story as there is in opera.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge relationship between film music and ballet, and the early great composers working in Hollywood, remember, almost all of them were Germans and Northern Europeans who mm-hmm. came over to the United States between the wars and in World War II. And it was and they brought that teaching, you know, what they had learned of the great European symphonic tradition with them, which includes Tchaikovsky. This is one of my favorite parts, just the music. And then it just explodes, and it's so beautiful.
And for us, this is the Snow Queen, mm-hmm. pas-de-deux.
Mm-hmm.
And in some versions, it was actually Clara dancing with the prince.
Mm-hmm.
But in our version, with Ben Stevenson version, it is the Snow Queen and the prince performing for Clara as a child.
Okay. How did you decide to go with that variation on the Nutcracker as opposed to Clara and the...
It's all up to the choreographer, and we do Ben Stevenson's version of the Nutcracker, and he took what he wanted to do with the story. He changed and arranged a lot of mm-hmm. the libretto. It's quite different than the original score,
mm-hmm.
and so his is unique to what he wanted to portray. And being from England, he brings a completely different humor than perhaps the original Russian version.
Mm-hmm. He brings humor, since he's from the England.
Yes.
That was the worst joke I've told all day. All right. So where are we going
in
the music
now?
Do you want to tell us some of the other ones? It's snowing.
That's all I got.
Yeah.
It's now about to snow in Houston.
Yeah.
And so the snowflakes are now going to do Waltz of the Snowflakes. Mm-hmm.
And so you hear this sort of pew, 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 this whole sort of, that was terrible, but this whole sort of flute line, and it perfectly captures that kind of color of this. If you imagine a snowflake falling in irregular
patterns.
And
one at a time, and you're just looking at one, and
exactly.
you see another, and it lands, and then suddenly there's three and four
right.
and five,
but
and it grows.
It captures
to
that randomness with the way you know, snowflakes flutter and fall, you know, that there is no predictable pattern in terms of the way they fall down. And here the music captures that in these flute lines, which are so wonderful. And again, the harp is so prominent in all of this score. It's really, this is quite a workout for the harpist. And it's a lot, I mean, they probably do more in this one score than they probably do most of the rest of the season. They're so busy. But Tchaikovsky loved the color. And again, the harp communicates that sense of wonder and enchantedness and fantasy and magic. It's if you go and listen to Harry Potter scores, John Williams uses them. So I mean, it's an association we've carried for forever.
Sure. When you think of transitioning to a dream in a movie, mm-hmm. you automatically hear the harp. Yeah. That's great.
And it's just got these wonderful, wonderful colors in here. And then, of course, this is the only section of the entire ballet that has any vocal part. Now, no words are sung, but it's Tchaikovsky brought in, and here it is, Tchaikovsky brought in a children's chorus. And again, the beautiful quality of the wonderment of we're going to a faraway place, a land of enchantment, and this the wonder of seeing the eyes through the, you know, seeing the world through the eyes of a child on many levels.
It does really bring another level to the movement as well, and you'd see the snowflakes moving from side to side. Mm-hmm. Their arms are waving up and over. Mm-hmm. And up and over with this part of the vocal. Mm-hmm. And for years we didn't have vocal, so we're so excited to have the girls' choir join us. It just brings it to another level, mm-hmm. even for the dancers to be able to hear that section, which we didn't hear for years.
Does the choir actually come out on stage and sing, or are they in the pit?
No, the Houston Girls Chorus girls are down in the pit with the Houston Ballet Orchestra, and so they actually kind of sneak in to the pit. They don't stand there for the entire first act because that would be hard for any group of children to do. but what they do is we kind of, during the fight scene, because it's the loudest scene during Act One, the girls all kind of...
telling all our secrets,
I know,
Michael.
I'm sorry, but we only have 18 to 20 girls sing per performance, and they come in during the fight scene, and then they set up back there, and then it's just a few minutes that they wait. During the scene, we heard the entrance with the snow, and then we come to this section, and this is the end of Act One. Right. And of course, they get snow on them because snow falls into the orchestra pit all the time.
Oh, that's adorable.
All the musicians end up with snow on them, basically. But even the musicians kept, when the girls sang it last year, the musicians all said, this is so great to have a real chorus here. Right. And it was what Tchaikovsky originally intended.
It provides the full score.
It does.
Mm-hmm. It really completes it. Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of doing a full score, I did a classical classroom short on the 1812 overture, and Tchaikovsky was really into using unusual elements in his music, wasn't he? There were the canons, here, like bringing in a chorus just for this small
section. I mean, it's actually quite a commitment when you think about it. To you have to have a choir sort of on hand for every performance to sing the show. So when you reach a certain point in your career, you can ask for those things. and it's not just the choir, but in one of the excerpts we'll listen to next, the very, very famous dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, Tchaikovsky makes very liberal use of the celeste, which is a keyboard instrument, but inside of it is bells. Mm. And this was, at the time, a new instrument. Tchaikovsky had discovered it in Paris, and he wanted to he wanted to use it before anybody else did. Mm-hmm. And so he raced back and included it in his Nutcracker score, although he'd used it in one score previous to this, but the Nutcracker was the first score with the major hearing of the celeste in it. And so to me that's so astonishing as a composer to think, wow, there'd be this like brand new instrument that I'd be like racing to include in my piece before anybody else did, so I could take advantage of this exciting new sound.
Well, that reminds me of, it just automatically makes me think of like DJs who, rush out to buy the latest equipment so that they can get the cool
or
sound.
Or the newest recording by whatever pop star it is, so that they can break the record first. I mean, that was... certainly that was a big deal back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Here's our waltz of the flowers.
And the other probably second most famous excerpt from the Nutcracker. Mm-hmm. And this is a great example of how, from a musical perspective, how Tchaikovsky thinks in families, juxtaposing here the brass and then... we'll have a statement by the brass, and then there'll be an answer in the woodwinds. Mm-hmm. And going into the clarinet here, and he loves to juxtapose the instrumental families together with the strings playing, sort of filling in the glue in the background. And here,
so this is the lead flowers dancing. Mm-hmm. It's a male and female doing a pas de deux along with the corps that's doing the waltz with them.
Explain what that means, pas de deux.
Pas de deux is a dance for two. Mm-hmm. And then you have the corps, which is all the dancers around the special couple that get to do the dance for two. Mm-hmm. And it's also another major role that the dancers in the company look forward to be able to perform that role. Mm-hmm. You can imagine doing 35, 37 Nutcrackers. So there's a lot of casting changes. We usually have 12 casts that perform, and we rotate through.
Yeah, because this is what, a couple of times a week for an entire month.
When we get to Christmas, it's 10 times a week.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, there's matinees and evening performances. Matinee,
yeah, exactly.
So all the dancers need time to recover.
Right.
On some levels, as do the musicians. I mean, mm-hmm. I was told a quote that it's something like, it's over 100 different musicians actually will play in the orchestra over the run of the Nutcracker. It's not the same 75 players the whole time. They swap out. And people need breaks. There's four different conductors, right? I mean, primarily it's Hermano, yes. But then there are guest conductors who come in.
It kind of sounds like the, you know, performing of the Nutcracker every year is sort of like the orchestral and dance company version of like a marathon. I mean, it's just like, it sounds like there's so much juggling involved to make it, you know,
it's a major organizational undertaking.
It is. You have injuries, mm-hmm. you have to train. It's a puzzle piece. And if you move one dancer out of one role, you've got to move five other dancers into other roles often.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness.
So, yeah, we manage it every day. Mm-hmm.
Talk about what's happening in the story right now.
Well, Clara's watching the flowers performing. Okay. It's the lead flowers that are actually dancing. And it's a waltz, so mm-hmm. very similar to the waltz that I'm sure you do on Friday night when you go out dancing.
Totally. Just like it.
It's a little bit different. But it's building here. This is, there's grand jeté en tenance. It's a leap in the air where your legs switch in the air.
I've seen that. That is incredible. Just to see someone do that.
And then when the lead flowers go off stage and the corps is dancing and the lead flowers come back on, it's building to this finale or coda as they come out and they're all dancing together and you can hear the music building.
Mm-hmm.
I just love this music.
I'm sure
I never get tired of this music. It's amazing.
Even
it's,
when you go into the store and you go shopping, you hear it in the background.
I'd rather hear that than most Christmas carols, I think, and that you hear in a lot of stores. I'd
it's
much
true.
Rather hear this.
I don't tire of this as much as I do, say, like Frosty the Snowman.
Frosty the Snowman is, you know, he has his place, but this is just so much more fun.
Yeah.
And I love listening to, I mean, it's always the color for me, for Tchaikovsky, just these beautiful, beautiful colors that he achieves in the music and how he trades voices around and call and response between sections of the orchestra. It's just what gives it all its dynamism and color for me.
And so by this time, Clara has now left the snow scene and she's going into the land of sweets. In Ben Stevenson's version, it's the lemonade sea that she travels through and she flies through the air in the coach at the end of Act One in the sleigh. And then she appears and it's just very magical arriving at the land of sweets with, we have flying cooks through the air and there are big cakes on stage and furry animals and it just completely changes where she's left and it just, it celebrates that transition and it becomes even more magical.
What's everything a child could ever want? Here it is.
That's why every little girl wants to be Clara.
That's right.
In the Nutcracker.
Hey, if there's lots of fuzzy, cute animals and cakes flying through the air, I'll be Clara. That'd be great.
I'll be sure to tell Stan Welch.
I'm sure he'd love to
audition for Clara's role.
That will not happen.
Please, I would so go see that.
But here you can hear it. I'll change the topic and we'll go to the, and here's the celeste and that wonderful sort of hollow, bellish kind of sound.
Yeah.
This had only, Tchaikovsky had used this in one piece briefly before this, but here it's so incredibly prominent. And this wonderful sound, and it's now become, it's, you can find it in many, many pieces since then. Mm-hmm. But this was the first really major time this was ever used. And
that is the coolest sound.
It's a great sound. When you see one, it's such an unassuming little box when you see one. Mm-hmm. And they're really quite odd in and of themselves, but the sound is so wonderful.
I had that part right there. I had always wondered how those bell people could play so fast. Well, now I know.
Now you know. It's a keyboard. Just like a piano. It's about a third the size of a piano keyboard.
Okay.
Another mystery solved.
Yeah.
I know. More secrets of the ballet.
I know.
And what happens at the end? So she... Now there's differences in the stories of what happens
at
the end.
Yeah, I read a little bit about
that. But if I tell you the end, it'll ruin it.
Well, that's true. You have to come down
You'll have to come to the Wortham Center to see the performance of Nutcracker to see what happens to Clara.
What
Does she
to
return
Clara?
To reality? Does she wake up out of this dream?
Is she stuck in fantasy land forever? Oh, man. Wow, this has been incredible. I really appreciate you guys coming in today to talk about this. I had no idea, especially the sort of... behind the scenes element of what goes on. All right, so I hope that this show has gotten you into the holiday spirit, and maybe I'll see you listeners out at a performance of The Nutcracker. Okay, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. We hope you enjoyed this trip down holiday memory lane. As I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, we've got a two-part series on the music of the Coen Brothers films coming up in the following weeks, which include lots of classical music, but also include some other things like banjos. Don't forget to subscribe to, rate us, and review us on iTunes while you're sitting around for the holidays. Send me email at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Thanks to audio producer Tiny Tot Holslander for twiddling knobs today. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing Christmas light eyes. Thanks to Michael Remsen and Shelley Power for being on the show. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. Happy holidays.